Hugh Bennett for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. A cover story this week, Japan's $18 billion bet on North Carolina. North Carolina's long push to attract investment from Japan is paying off across the state. Before the cover story, we'll do the biz section and some of the reporter pages. Biz is written by managing editor Dane Huffman. His main story this week, Shorty's thrives as Wake Forest booms. Chris Joyner is the fourth generation in his family to run iconic hot dog shop. The astounding growth in Wake Forest has been a blessing for a business that dates to the First World War. Shorty's has served hot dogs on White Street since 1916, and the welcoming locale with its old-school ambiance has thrived along with the town. "Every day we get somebody coming in saying they just moved here," said Chris Joyner, the fourth generation to run the family business. "We get a ton of new people." Shorty's, named for his great uncle, has booths and bar stools that look like something from the set of Happy Days, and a hot dog grill that's 90 years old. But the restaurant has faced hard times. It once thrived by serving students at Wake Forest College, including a young Arnold Palmer. When the college moved to Winston-Salem in 1956, the town was devastated. "I heard stories from my dad and grandfather about how hard it was to stay in business after the college left," Joyner said. "It was like a ghost town. Shorty scraped and clawed and made it through." After COVID, Shorty's is rolling again, with a half dozen loyal employees churning out 100,000 hot dogs a year. That's a big jump from the 75,000 Joyner sold a decade ago. Shorty's is believed to be the oldest area restaurant. The Carolina Coffee Shop in Chapel Hill dates to 1922, the Mecca in Raleigh to 1930, and King's Sandwich Shop in Durham to 1942. Prices at Shorty's remain cheap. A hot dog is $3.15, a hamburger is $3.99, and an Arnold Palmer, a mix of lemonade and tea, is $3.50. Joyner owns his building and has benefited from a town that exploded from 30,000 people in 2010 to more than 54,000 now. "It's obviously been big for us," Joyner said. "The more people come down here, the more business we get." La Farm in Cary celebrates milestone. La Farm Bakery is celebrating its 25th anniversary from October 23rd to October 26th. Lionel Vatinet, or Vatinet, along with co-owner Missy Vatinet and Chief Operating Officer Omar Gay, have grown the Cary Bakery, which first opened in 1999, to multiple locations throughout the Triangle. To celebrate, the bakery will donate 25% of all its sourdough boule sales through October 26 to the North Carolina Hospitality Worker Relief Fund. The farm now has a cafe at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, and plans to open a 3,200-square-foot location at Creekside Crossing Shopping Center later this year. Home of UNC legend on the market. The former Governor's Club home of the late Eric Montross is on the market for more than $3 million. The home outside Chapel Hill is listed for $3.5 million. The home spans 7,550 square feet and has four bedrooms, three full baths and three half baths. It sits on a 2.5-acre wooded lot at 32430 Archdale Drive. Montross, who died last year after a battle with cancer, was a key member of the team that won the NCAA championship in 1993. The 7-footer played 8 seasons in the NBA and also was an analyst for the Tar Heel Sports Network for 18 seasons. Con battle continues in state courts, that's C-O-N. It's easy to get lost in the legal wrangling over the state's certificate of need decisions, and it honestly can seem pretty petty at times. But a recent ruling by the state Supreme Court could have major implications on how medical facilities are developed in the state and would impact millions of dollars of investment when it comes to health care. In 2020, Dr. Jay Singleton, a newborn ophthalmologist, filed a lawsuit claiming North Carolina's con law violates the state's constitution. Both the Wake County Superior Court and the State Court of Appeals swatted away Singleton's concerns, but now the Supreme Court is telling the lower court to take up the case again. More expansion for Spiffy. Spiffy, a Research Triangle Park startup offering on-demand car care services, is expanding its services by integrating with car dealerships. The company announced that Bozard Ford Lincoln of St. Augustine, Florida, is now offering its service, and Spiffy is now fully integrated with Reynolds & Reynolds, an Ohio company that offers software services for the automobile industry. The Transportation and Development section is written by Lauren Onosorge. Raleigh execs sound off over downtown parking. As the city of Raleigh makes a big bet on free parking, some power players in the business community say it's not enough to curb downtown's reputation for having a lack of accessibility. And at least one business conference could leave downtown due to parking enforcement. The Raleigh City Council recently passed plans to launch a two-hour free parking pilot, a program officials hope will attract more business to downtown. But there are limitations to the program, particularly for those looking at street parking at or near their destination. Executives say the pilot program, which covers a handful of parking garages, is a good first step, but that they're hoping more solutions are coming. Bill Spruill, the entrepreneur who co-founded a Global Data Consortium and led it through its $300 million buyout by the London Stock Exchange Group 2 years ago, is fed up after a recent $20 parking ticket. "You're in a situation where you're looking for people to transact downtown. That's my big gripe here," he said, about the ticket he got after picking up a pizza at Vic's Italian Restaurant and Pizzeria. Spruill posted about the parking ticket on LinkedIn, and several leading executives commented with their own complaints. Spruill is aware of Raleigh's pilot plan to offer 2 hours of free parking in five decks starting in November, but he fears it's not enough. Bill King, CEO of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, says parking is a concern. He added that it's why his group advocated so hard for the two-hour parking plan. "Parking decks have the capacity to spare now that many people are working remotely," King said. David Meeker, managing partner of Carpenter Development and a partner at Trophy Brewing Downtown, calls the two-hour pilot a huge deal. But he too said it's not the entire answer. "You've got to strike the right balance," he said. "You can't have predatory ticketing, but you need a steady rotation of those cars because those cars are customers." RDU loses flights to top vacation destinations. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is losing multiple flights to popular vacation destinations. Bahamas Air does not plan to return to RDU amid a spat with U.S. carriers over fees. The airline, which initially launched nonstop flights from RDU to Freeport in the Bahamas in 2022, confirmed the move but did not give a reason for its decision to suspend its RDU service. JetBlue has suspended RDU service to Cancun and Orlando effective October 26th. Both Cancun and Orlando are routes offered by other airlines, according to RDU's destination list. American Airlines and Delta Airlines both fly to Cancun, and Orlando is served by Delta, Frontier, and Southwest. Bahamas Air is in the midst of a back-and-forth dispute with U.S. trade group Airlines for America, which asked the U.S. Department of Transportation to prohibit Bahamas Air from flying U.S. routes altogether, claiming the Bahamas government is charging unreasonable air navigation service fees, violating its air transport agreement with the United States. In a filing last month, Airlines for America asked the Department of Transportation to deny Bahamas Air's application to renew its U.S. airport authority because its government, quote, "continues to unjustifiably and unreasonably discriminatively impose unjustified excessive user charges," unquote. Bridge repairs at Neuse River to cause traffic headaches. For years, drivers in Raleigh have been hit with a significant bump when they drive over the Neuse River Bridge on Falls of Neuse Road. Now the city is embarking on a two-phase project to repair the structure, which typically sees about 26,000 vehicles each day. But there's a big, annoying catch. This repair will require a complete detour, meaning drivers will have to find alternative routes. Jason Holmes, transportation director for the city of Raleigh, said the bump has been the subject of a lot of phone calls over the years. The $604,000 project, with the 15% contingency budget, is designed to eliminate the hazard. The bump comes from settlement on the approach slab, the section of concrete between the roadway and the bridge structure. The slab starts to dip, and just a couple of inches can cause a significant bump. The plan is to repair all four slabs, both northbound and southbound. The project will happen in two phases. The first phase involves shutting down the northbound lanes, and phase two involves the southbound side. Each phase has a 4-week timeline. Kate Tracy writes the retail and restaurant section. Chef takes swing at Italian cuisine. John Scarangella has opened his second restaurant in Raleigh, this time with an Italian theme. Italian by heritage, the Raleigh chef and his wife Carol are serving Italian dishes at Encore Ristorante at 11211 Galleria Avenue in the shops at Wakefield Park in Northeast Raleigh near Wake Forest. The 3,000-square-foot restaurant is located in the former Bruno Seafood and Steaks off a burgeoning corridor along Capitol Boulevard and Falls of Neuse Road, near where a new Marriott Hotel and Costco store are in the works. We're hoping to be that neighborhood staple, the same way Northside is by Northridge Country Club, said Scarangella, whose other restaurant, Northside Bistro and Cocktails, opened in 2021. The Encore menu features a variety of homemade pastas, Italian desserts, steaks, and Scarangella's take on lasagna bolognese he learned how to make in Bologna. The beverage menu includes craft cocktails and a constantly rotating wine list featuring bottles that start at $40. Encore technically opened this summer and has been slowly ramping up. The restaurant has 22 employees now. Scarangella paid the Bruno owners $175,000 to purchase their business assets. He spent another $275,000 on extensive renovations of the kitchen, bar, and dining room. Scarangella said he funded the new location through personal funds as well as an individual investor. Encore has seating for 75 guests inside, while an outdoor patio holds another 32 people. Rent at the space is just under $9,000. I assume they mean per month. Scarangella moved to the Triangle 16 years ago and started working in restaurants. Last year, Northside brought in $2.5 million in revenue. Northside honestly was a gift. I don't know how it worked so well. It's just ridiculous. The neighborhood took to it. We opened right out of COVID, and people just were flocking to restaurants, and they gravitated to us, and it's been really, really solid since we opened, he said. Scarangella does not see himself opening any more restaurants. He prefers to be hands-on, cooking every day, training employees, and taking orders. In other restaurant news, Barrio Tacos to open at Smoky Hollow. Kane Realty's Smoky Hollow in downtown Raleigh has added another restaurant that plans to open early next year. Barrio's Tacos and Tequila and Whiskey, a taco joint with locations in Michigan, Ohio, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida, is making its debut in North Carolina. Barrio has leased 3,415 square feet at 421 South Harrington Street, next to the Crunkleton, a Chapel Hill-based cocktail bar opening soon. Founded in Ohio in 2012, Barrio has grown to more than 20 locations. The menu allows guests to build their own tacos in six steps. If guests don't want to build their own, they can choose from taco menu or specials. Stacy Busher, managing director of operations at Kane Realty, said Barrio's build-your-own-taco concept and vibrant environment are a perfect fit for the community we're fostering at Smoky Hollow. Smoky Hollow has added new tenants recently. Among them is a longtime culinary teacher's new cooking studio called Hone Sharpen. The Triangle has scored a few new taco restaurants in recent months. Jalmex Hospitality Group opened Tacos Number Juan, that's J-U-A-N, in a former Wendy's south of downtown Durham. Atomi Comida y Cocteles opened earlier this year in Raleigh. Near Dick's Park, a Pilates studio is coming to new Kane Realty project. After 20 years as a Pilates student and instructor, a former real estate executive is opening her own studio in Raleigh. Julia Davis, whose business background includes leadership stints at Soho House and WeWork, will be a co-owner of Raleigh's first BK Pilates studio, located below the Row Apartments in Kane Realty's upcoming Rockway development near Dick's Park. The nearly 2,000-square-foot studio will open in early 2025. BK Pilates has two locations in New York City, two in Charlotte and one in Charleston. For the last 4 years, Davis has been a consultant for real estate, hospitality, and lifestyle projects. Before that, she was the chief development officer for the Americas at the Members Club Soho House. She launched the co-working branch of Soho House called Soho Works. Prior to Soho House, she was global head of real estate transactions at WeWork. Davis holds a bachelor's degree from Meredith College in Raleigh and an MBA from UNC Chapel Hill. She moved back to the Triangle during the pandemic. So far, BK Pilates has one neighbor, Benchwarmers Bagels, which has taken 4,000 square feet of retail space at the Row Apartments. And for those wondering what weird new foods are available at the State Fair this year, here's an article that has your answer. Fun options highlight food at NC State Fair. The North Carolina State Fair returned this week with a plethora of new food options. The annual event, which dates to 1853 and draws close to 1 million attendees to the fairgrounds in West Raleigh, is known for its wide array of fair food, from the funky to the delicious. This year's fair comes with 73 new food items, a big jump from last year's 48 new dishes. Many come from vendors local to the Triangle and restaurants across North Carolina. The fair wraps up October 27th. Adult admission tickets cost $13 for ages 13 to 64 at the gate, and $7 for ages 6 through 12. Children 5 and under are free. While most food at the fair is quite accessible, others come with long lines or exorbitant prices. Cool Runnings Jamaican was a popular choice for guests on opening day, October 17th, with many customers waiting in line to try the food. The Jerk Pork Belly Bao was new this year. Meanwhile, Oak City Fish and Chips are selling an Alaskan King Crab Pop, basically crab on a stick, for a whopping $67. Here are some fair foods that are new this year. Las Gringas has an al pastor stick, which is served with tortillas, onion, cilantro, and pineapple for $16. Waypoint Oyster Bar has North Carolina crab and shrimp bomb crusted in hot Cheetos for $16. La Farm Bakery has fried cheesy croissant for $9. Ethio Indie Alkaline Cuisine, which is fried fufu, which is a fried ball of root vegetables, for $12. Magdalena's Chimney Cakes offers Granny Cone, a chimney cake stuffed with corn cake, and maple bacon ice cream topped with whipped cream for $20. Here are some other options. Lawrence and Perry Barbecue offers deep fried ribs. N&T Concession offers chamoy or chamoy pineapples. Red Carpet Amusements offers a dilly dog, which is a beef hot dog stuffed inside a dill pickle and fried in panko butter. Bulgogi Korean Barbecue offers Korean barbecue kimchi nachos. Last year, 925,000 visitors came to the NC State Fair, which is consistently one of the largest fairs in the country. The fair's record attendance came in 2010, when 1,091,887 guests showed up. The last time the fair hit 1 million attendees was in 2017. This year, the forecast is nearly flawless. Through October 21st, attendance was above 400,000 and pacing ahead of 2023. Here's a reporter section we don't see as often. It's called On the Coast. It's written by David Pertell. His main story, the cost to save an OBX home at risk. So far this year, five Rodanthe homeowners have been unable to remove their homes in time before oceanfront erosion brought them down, bringing the total of homes collapsed since 2020 to 10. Given the cost, limited lots available, and paperwork, relocation can take a long time. The average demolition cost is about $120,000, according to a report by an interagency work group put together by North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality and the National Park Service's Cape Hatteras National Seashore. The cost to save and relocate the home climbs to an average of $150,000, according to a report from WTKR. For some homeowners, that's almost as much as the value of the home itself. One two-story home at 24,131 Ocean Drive, which collapsed in May 2024, had a building assessed value of $164,000. Some homeowners look for grant money or insurance to help, but most grants are for homes that are primary residences, and several homes along the Outer Banks are secondary homes. And with most insurance policies, there has to be some type of loss to the structure before payouts are made. David Halleck, superintendent for National Parks of Eastern North Carolina, said relocation is the only method that can save these houses right now. Because there are no longer dunes anywhere near the homes and there isn't enough sand, the pilings of a home end up constantly sitting in water at each tide, causing erosion. Once that happens, the pilings break and the house collapses. Donna Creef, Government Affairs Director for the Outer Banks Association of Realtors, said these events have impacted whether people choose to rent or buy in the area. Areas where homes have collapsed have become less marketable than the other villages in the region, or the northern Outer Banks. This is despite the fact that there are still miles of beach with no threatened oceanfront structures. The next article is personally sad for me. Restaurant Group files for Chapter 11. A Wilmington restaurant chain has filed for bankruptcy, joining a string of bankruptcies in North Carolina tied to U.S. Small Business Administration loans. The Thai and Vietnamese restaurant Indochine, along with its associated brands Indochine Express and Cafe Chinois, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on October 4th. Indochine has one location at 7 Wayne Drive in Wilmington. Indochine Express, which also serves Thai and Vietnamese food but in a more fast casual environment, has two locations in Wilmington, one in Southport and one in Leland. Cafe Chinois has one location in Wilmington at 3710 South College Road that serves Thai, Korean, Vietnamese, and other Asian flavors. Owner Solange Thompson signed the paperwork for the bankruptcy filing. Attorney George Mason Oliver with the Newbern law firm Oliver & Cheek is representing Indochine and its related LLC entities in the bankruptcy. Neither Thompson nor her attorney responded to requests for comment. The largest unsecured claim that Indochine has is for $2.36 million loan from North State Bank. Indochine also owes the SBA $1.5 million per bankruptcy documents. In total, Indochine's debts are less than $3.202 million. Its assets are between $0 and $50,000, according to the bankruptcy filing. Business bankruptcies have ticked up this year, particularly ones saddled with SBA loans that originated during the pandemic. NC startup builds docks designed for hurricanes. Hurricanes and an entrepreneurial itch is how Rich Whitmire got the idea for the startup that would become Ghost Crab Docks on the North Carolina coast. Whitmire isn't the entrepreneurial stereotype, having taken on the role after more than three decades at General Electric, but he said he's always had entrepreneurial inklings. So instead of retiring, he bet on a startup. Now, 2 years after launching, Ghost Crab Docks, based in Hempstead up Highway 17 from Wilmington, has eclipsed $1 million in sales. The company makes boat docks that can be uninstalled quickly and easily ahead of a storm. The first dock prototype was cobbled together out of wood and built in Whitmire's garage. Later iterations were made from aluminum and high-density polyethylene surfaces, creating light panels that would be much easier to remove and install. And finally, coastal home prices are still heating up. A home in Wilmington sold at the end of September for more than $6.4 million, the highest price ever for the 28409 zip code, according to Full Circle Real Estate, which handled the listing. The waterfront property on Skystasail Drive sits on 0.85 acres by an inlet in the exclusive Shandy Points neighborhood. The home offers more than 4,700 square feet of living space with four bedrooms and four baths. There's also a boat dock. The buyer is a trust linked to David E. Hackman. The seller is entrepreneur Philip Maklowski, who along with his wife Haley renovated the property after acquiring it in 2022 for $3.8 million, according to property records in New Hanover County. The 28409 zip code covers the South Wilmington and Myrtle Grove areas. Let's turn now to our cover story, the Japan Effect. Decades-long relationship accelerates as Japanese firms set to invest billions in North Carolina. The article was co-written by Lauren Onasorge and Ben Tobin. The usual suspects came across Kiowa Kirin's list when its company executives were deciding which location to place a $200 million biomanufacturing facility. The Japanese pharmaceutical manufacturer, which ultimately selected Sanford in February for the 100-job project, looked at Switzerland and Ireland, according to Paul Testa, the company's executive vice president for supply chain and manufacturing in North America. In the United States, the company searched coast to coast, from San Francisco to New Jersey and Boston. And, of course, you can't do a national search without understanding that Raleigh is in the process of exploding from a healthcare perspective, he said. So what gave North Carolina the edge over these other areas to lure this investment? Labor supply with several major universities in the Research Triangle area and a plethora of community colleges certainly helped, but the longstanding relationship between the North Carolina and Japan business communities may have sealed the deal. The governor, meaning Roy Cooper, made a trip to Tokyo back in fall 2023, Testa said in an interview with Triangle Business Journal earlier this year, and you know that made an impression on our corporate stakeholders here in Tokyo. Per the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, 67 Japanese companies have made $18 billion in capital investments in North Carolina over just the past decade, creating more than 9,000 jobs. Since 2017, Japanese companies have been approved for more than 364,622,000 in state incentives, making the stakes for their relationship that much higher. From Ajinomoto launching a manufacturing site in Raleigh in 1982 to Kyowa Kirin creating a new plant in Lee County 40 years later, Japanese investment in North Carolina has been crucial for the explosion of the Old North State's economy. Japan is the top country worldwide for announced capital investments and new jobs created in North Carolina, according to the Public-Private Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, which leads recruitment efforts for new investments. And as the Research Triangle continues to try to position itself as the go-to spot for life sciences investments in manufacturing, the state's relationship to Japan will be integral for attracting even larger companies in the years to come. Local businesses are reaping the benefits, too, per Stephen Sumner, director of the North Carolina Japan Center at NC State University. When you build factories like Toyota Battery and Kyowa Kirin are, they're employing local construction companies. They're buying equipment for their factories. They're having technicians install that equipment in their factories, Sumner said. So the tentacles from groundbreaking projects like these really extend deep within the economy here in North Carolina. How the relationship began. The push started in the 1980s with companies like Ajinomoto and Mitsubishi Semiconductor. While previous governors had explored the potential foreign direct investment held for the state, it was Governor Jim Hunt who went all in. I started touring the world to find more companies to come here. We needed jobs, and Japan was a great place to find them, Hunt would later tell WRAL. We're invested in education. That's been the key to it. And then going out and selling North Carolina and being part of the world. Under Hunt's administration, the NC Japan Center was founded in 1980. And that's when the big push for Japanese investment started coming into North Carolina, former NC Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland said. The center would not only provide academic opportunities statewide for students to learn Japanese language and culture, but also it sought to attract Japanese businesses to the state, making what Sumner describes as the soft sell. Copeland said the key to closing deals in the early days was messaging. Japanese CEOs knew about the Research Triangle, about Duke University and Pinehurst No. 2, and that was about it, he said. Steve Brantley, now Economic Development Director for Orange County, echoed the sentiment, adding in the international fame of NBA superstar Michael Jordan. To spread the message, developers had to meet the Japanese where they were, and sometimes that meant taking them to see Jordan's jersey at the UNC Chapel Hill, Brantley said. Brantley, who had spent time in the Navy in Japan, led the charge at commerce back then. He recalls a 24-hour approach. If Japanese executives flew in on a Friday, he would entertain them all weekend, a Durham Bulls game on Saturday, and a golf outing on Sunday before the site tour on Monday. And once a company was hooked, the Japan Center would help reel in the next one by connecting its transplanted executives with the Japanese community, as well as to accomplish logistical tasks like getting driver's licenses. The experiences Japanese executives shared with their compatriots will go a long way toward securing interest from the next company, and it still does all of those things today. When it comes to economic development, we try to make clear as a selling point that we have a well-coordinated academic pipeline trying to produce Japanese-speaking graduates or graduates who are aware of Japanese culture to support all of the firms that have decided to set up business in North Carolina, Sumner said. Investing in the early days required commitment. Brantley recalls some projects taking a dozen site visits to close and multiple rounds at Pinehurst No. 2. John Atkins, chairman and CEO of O'Brien, Atkins, and former honorary consul of Japan, said that along with the sophistication of operating a global company, executives brought their friendship. They wanted to invest in North Carolina from a culture standpoint. One top exec, he recalls, even sang the national anthem for an opening pitch at a Bulls game. People realize these are great people to work with. These are great companies to work with, he said, and they hired locally. They didn't say, okay, we're going to relocate 300 Japanese guys. They trained and hired local North Carolinians, Atkins said. There were some things lost in translation that required some back and forth. Japan didn't have the equivalent of North Carolina's community college training incentives in the early days, and it took some education to get them to understand the benefit. But when the wind started, they stacked up. Companies like Eisai, which chose Research Triangle Park more than two decades ago for a pharma manufacturing facility, and Eisen, which pushes transmissions off its assembly lines in Durham. Honda's aviation branch established a research facility at the Piedmont Triad International Airport in 2000. By 2007, Honda Aircraft Company announced it had selected Greensboro to be its $100 million world headquarters and production facility. The firm would continue to invest in the state, including with Honda Aero's jet engine manufacturing complex in Burlington, and the winds kept coming. In 2011, Fujifilm Corp. agreed to buy Merck & Company's biomanufacturing network, which included a local biotechnology manufacturing plant operating under the name DioSynth RTP. That led to a slew of additional investments and expansions, including one announced earlier this year amounting to $1.2 billion and 680 jobs, which will bring its Holly Springs facility's headcount to 1,400 by 2031. And in 2021, Toyota would break ground on its massive battery factory near Greensboro. The facility, which will produce electric vehicle batteries and employ 5,000 people, is the largest industrial site in North Carolina history and has led multiple Toyota suppliers to invest in the state. Insiders say it's also what helped put North Carolina on the radar for other wins, such as that of VinFast, a Vietnamese company that wants to build an automotive assembly plant in Chatham County. That project has seen multiple delays. Don Mather, Senior Vice President of Biopharma Manufacturing at Astellas Pharma, a Japanese firm that acquired the Audentes Therapeutics operation in Sanford, said the relationships matter, but so does the region's record of success. From a delivery standpoint, the facility and the team that we built here just consistently delivers, he said, noting top executives visit the site and take pride in the team and culture that we have there. Japan's investment in North Carolina. Japanese business investment announcements in North Carolina have nearly eclipsed $2 billion in 2024 alone, according to a Triangle Business Journal analysis of the data. Though new facility and expansion announcements, five Japanese companies have pledged this year to add 1,351 jobs to North Carolina. Those company and investments with projected jobs in parentheses are Kyowa Kirin, $200 million for pharmaceutical manufacturing plant in Sanford and offering 102 new jobs. Morinaga, or Morinaga, $136 million for second candy manufacturing facility in Mebane, which offers 204 new jobs. Nipro, $397.8 million medical device manufacturing facility in Greenville, 232 new jobs. Fujihatsu and Toyotsu battery components, $60 million for an EV battery manufacturing facility in Liberty to support Toyota. That's 133 new jobs. Fujifilm DioSynth Biotechnologies, $1.2 billion to add to a monoclonal antibodies facility in Holly Springs. And that's 680 new jobs. This adds to what has already been a large pool of investments from Japanese companies. According to Sumner, there are 995 Japanese-owned sites across North Carolina that employ at least one person. Those 995 sites are operated by 256 unique companies that have a Japanese parent company. And among those 256 unique companies, 56 have their U.S. headquarters in North Carolina, per Sumner. In all, these Japanese-owned companies employ over 36,000 North Carolinians, he said. And more are coming, as officials confirm the state continues to field inquiries from Japanese companies looking to invest. If they know about North Carolina, we're very confident we're at least going to get consideration. Chris Chung, CEO of EDPNC, said, noting that once North Carolina is on the radar, the same factors come into play as with any site selection research: availability of talent, sites, and infrastructure. Future opportunities. For Josh Lewis, president and CEO of the Greenville Eastern North Carolina Alliance, a public-private partnership, North Carolina's pre-existing strong relationship with Japan was huge in courting medical device manufacturer Nipro to select Greenville for a new roughly $400 million facility. When you're at 12-hour time differences and you have this distance, it's easy for communications to go wrong, Lewis said. So just having that connectivity, those constant touch points, is super important for relationships when you're dealing with these foreign companies. This just proves that it's worth the time and investment. Robert Hanfield, professor of supply chain management in the Poole College of Management at NC State, said there is competition. Japanese companies, like most, are looking for places with business-friendly economics and talent proximity. But he said the history continues to give North Carolina a leg up. They like to form clusters in areas where there's already a Japanese presence, he said. Chung said every single win from Nippon to Fujifilm Diosynth further signals to other Japanese companies that this is a place they at least need to take a closer look at because many other Japanese companies are invested here. But there are barriers, mainly that not all Japanese companies know a lot about North Carolina, even decades after the relationship between the states took off. That's where EDPNC's boots on the ground come in. EDPNC maintains an office in Japan, staffed by an economic developer who speaks the language. He can then directly deliver North Carolina's message, as well as make connections to determine what sectors the state should get target next. Those kind of things can give you a bit of an edge, Chung said. So too can a direct line with the governor. Cooper's trip to Japan last year and his hosting of Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in April gave conversations a boost, and the state's commitment to host the 2024 Southeast U.S.-Japan Conference, known as SEUS-Japan in Charlotte, in late October is another opportunity. But the biggest non-negotiable, multiple executives said, is talent. Typically, executives fly in on jets, eyeing the sites they're considering for billion-dollar investments personally. But not Fujifilm Diosynth, as it was considering Holly Springs for an initial $2 billion investment. COVID-19 sent site searches online via Zoom-type conferences and video calls. Yes, Fujifilm already had an operation in RTP, but executives knew the stakes were particularly high as they were scouting locations from Singapore to Denmark to California for a biomanufacturing operation. But it came down to talent, not relationships. And it was tricky, even for a company like Fujifilm that had been operating here for decades. There's so much growth in the area, Chief Financial Officer Richard McAvoy remembers thinking. A reasonable question is, okay, is that talent pipeline actually going to be there? Or is the fact that there's so many companies choosing this area going to make it difficult for us to find talent? After multiple conversations with university personnel and recruiters, the company has now pledged to invest $3.1 billion in Holly Springs and hire more than 1,400 people. It's where is the talent, McAvoy said. The Viewpoint section this week has a guest columnist, John Hood, who's a frequent contributor. Which is wealthier, North Carolina or Germany, he asks. Although our state's economy has grown faster than the national average over the past decade, not everyone has fared well. Some regions are struggling, a condition now worsened in parts of western North Carolina by Hurricane Helene. Moreover, too many of our fellow North Carolinians lack the knowledge, skills, and opportunities to prosper even in our fastest-growing metros. It's important to put such challenges in proper perspective. North Carolina's problems aren't structural. We have a wealth of human, cultural, and natural resources. Our policy infrastructure is fundamentally sound. Many other states and countries would welcome our problems if they also came with our successes and advantages. I'm not just talking about places you might normally associate with disadvantage, poverty, and despair. The average North Carolinian is wealthier and has better prospects than the average German. According to a study by the European Center for International Policy Economy, North Carolina's gross domestic product was approximately $60,000 per resident in 2021. Among European Union countries with lower GDPs per capita than North Carolina's were Germany, the Netherlands, France, Sweden, Italy, and Spain. More broadly, reports The Economist, American output per capita is currently about 40% higher than in Canada or Western Europe, and 60% higher than Japan. That gap is about twice as large as it was in 1990. Since the start of 2020, just before the COVID-19 pandemic, America's real growth has been 10%, three times the average for the rest of the G7 countries, the magazine reported. Among the G20 group, which includes large emerging markets, America is the only one whose output and employment are above pre-pandemic expectations. International comparisons of economic output and incomes are tricky. Different statistical adjustments for purchasing power will produce different rankings. Other economic measures tell a similar story, however. Our homes are quite a bit larger, for example, than is typical in European or East Asia countries, and more likely to be air-conditioned and contain modern appliances and amenities. None of this is to suggest that we have little to learn from other countries. Germany has an excellent system of apprenticeships and job training programs. The education systems of such countries as South Korea and the Netherlands combine high academic standards with significant parental choice and competition, features we're only now adopting. Most European countries make extensive use of efficient private owner-operators for seaports, airports, rail lines, and other infrastructure, and a number of countries get a better bang for the buck on their healthcare expenditures than we do. I'm in favor of borrowing good ideas from wherever we can find them, but when it comes to economic performance as a whole, America remains a leader, not a laggard, with its recent growth powered by states such as North and South Carolina that boast many innovative companies and industries, healthy inflows of people and investment, and pro-enterprise policy environments. We have time to go back to the reporter pages now. Zach Ezone writes the healthcare and life sciences section. In the continuing medical wars, or what they call Battle of the Blues, Duke and UNC compete over future MRI scanner. Duke Health and UNC have filed competing proposals for the right to expand their imaging services in Durham County. The health systems are once again vying for expansion rights after submitting multi-million-dollar proposals to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, outlining plans to add a magnetic resonance imaging scanner in the county. The applications were filed in October in response to a need identified in the 2024 State Medical Facilities Plan, which called for one new MRI in Durham County. These needs are determined by various factors, including population growth and the use and availability of existing services. Duke Health proposes adding the new MRI scanner to an existing diagnostic center, Duke Imaging Arrington, located in a medical office building that houses other healthcare services, including a Duke Health Orthopedics Clinic. The medical office building is at 5601 Arrington Park Drive in Morrisville. If approved and completed, this project would increase the number of scanners at Duke Imaging Arrington to three. The projected capital expenditure is about $6 million. UNC Health proposes developing its first freestanding MRI scanner in Durham County. There are 18 existing or approved fixed MRI scanners in the county, most of which are based at various Duke Health facilities, except for two scanners that are operated by Emerge Ortho. UNC Health would lease and renovate 8,716 square feet of space in the existing building at 2700 Meridian Parkway, which would house both the MRI scanner and associated clinical services. The projected capital expenditure for UNC Health's proposal is about $8.7 million. The State Medical Facilities Plan identifies a need for one new MRI scanner in a service area that includes Durham, Caswell, and Warren counties. The state also called for one new MRI scanner each in Johnston, Orange, and Wake counties. NCDHHS recently approved Raleigh Radiology's proposal to add a new MRI scanner to its center in Clayton. UNC Health in August was the only healthcare provider to file an application for the available MRI scanner in Orange County. Raleigh CEO exits after selling company. A California-based women's health company has acquired a Raleigh startup and its medical device system. Caldera Medical has acquired UVision 360, Inc., the developer behind the Luminel system, which is designed to offer surgeons a more convenient and cost-effective option for certain gynecologic procedures that improves patient outcomes. The companies closed the deal in late September. Financial terms of the deal have not been disclosed. The acquisition supports the commercial expansion of the Luminel system, said CEO Allison London Brown, who co-founded UVision 360. Luminel has so far seen a limited commercial presence. By becoming part of Caldera, the company aims to advance its goal of bringing the Luminel system to more patients. Prior to reaching this deal, Luminel, with just a handful of employees, had considered other options to support a full market launch, but it was difficult to raise the funding needed, about $10 to $12 million, amid a challenging funding environment for smaller companies. As for Brown, who has led the company for nearly a decade, she is keeping her options open for what comes next. and company seeks $100 million in damages against Duke. A public company headquartered in Florida claims Duke University has breached a years-long license agreement and partnership between the two organizations. CryoCell International, in October, filed a demand for arbitration against Duke with the American Arbitration Association. The proceedings are private, but CryoCell claims that Duke fraudulently induced CryoCell to enter a license agreement and further breached the agreement on various occasions, according to a recent disclosure in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. CryoCell, in the securities filing, says it has informed Duke that the company believes damages exceed $100 million. Duke declined to comment, and CryoCell did not respond to requests for comment. CryoCell operates as a private cord blood bank that separates and preserves stem cells from umbilical cords for families. Through a partnership with the university, the company had plans to grow and further expand its business. The two organizations in early 2021 entered a license agreement that gave CryoCell the rights to certain technology and data related to cord blood and cord tissue developed at Duke. Ben Tobin writes about business happenings in the Greater Triangle area. Poultry giant buys Farmville plant. A national poultry producer has dropped eight figures to make an imprint on an eastern North Carolina county. Sanderson Farms purchased a 41,120-square-foot facility on roughly 15 acres at 3648 South Field Street in Farmville earlier this month for roughly $15 million, according to Pitt County deed records. The seller is Goldsboro Milling Company, a livestock food manufacturer. Jana Brackett, a spokeswoman for Sanderson Farms, said that the property in Pitt County is a feed mill that was purchased from Goldsboro Milling. The facility will continue to function as a feed mill, serving our farm partners in the Kinston and St. Paul's area, she said. Sanderson Farms is a subsidiary of Wayne Sanderson Farms based out of Oakwood, Georgia. Per the company's website, it's the third largest poultry producer in the United States with 26,000 employees, nine poultry brands, and 23 processing and prepared food plants. Three of those plants are in North Carolina, with the closest one to the triangle being in the Lenore County city of Kinston. This is just the latest big investment in Pitt County. In July, Nipro, a Japanese company that manufactures medical equipment, announced a roughly $400 million investment that will create 232 jobs in Greenville. Farmville is roughly 70 minutes east of Raleigh and has a population of about 4,500 people. This will be the company's first manufacturing plant in North Carolina and fifth in the United States. The company, headquartered in Osaka, Japan, has two facilities in New Jersey, one in Virginia, and one in Indiana. Poultry remains a major industry in North Carolina. The North Carolina Poultry Federation said the industry creates about 148,000 jobs in the state. The state is also among the national leaders in the annual production of chicken. In Franklin County, a Pennsylvania group grabs warehouse building. A Pennsylvania-based real estate investment and development company has paid big bucks for an industrial facility in the Triangle's fastest-growing county. An entity called 94 Cypress Partners, which is tied to an Altera property group, purchased an 8,545-square-foot facility on roughly 8 acres across two parcels at 94 Cypress Drive in Youngsville for $5.7 million, according to Franklin County deed records. The building includes offices and conference space. The seller is Missouri-based construction equipment firm Equipment Share. Mark Gannon, Altera's senior vice president of acquisitions, said, "We appreciate the property's accessibility to both Raleigh and Durham. 94 Cypress provides immediate access to Route 1 and Route 96, aligning to our overall strategy of acquiring assets in transportation-centric, high-growth locations," Gannon said. Franklin County's growth has been attracting sizable investments from real estate investors and home builders alike. The county's population grew by just shy of 3.5% between 2022 and 2023, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, and now has more than 70,000 residents. The only counties in the state that outpaced Franklin's growth were Pender and Brunswick, counties on the coast, which have attracted a large number of retirees from other states. For example, in August, Triangle Business Journal reported that Croatan Land Company, an LLC tied to Raleigh developer Gray Berry, purchased roughly 104 acres of Cedar Creek and Lane store roads in the town of Franklinton for $3.9 million, according to Franklin County deed records. Berry told TBJ at the time that the project will consist of 410 housing units, 211 single-family detached homes, and 199 townhomes. He said the project's developer will be Raleigh-based Gray Hill Development, an LLC tied to Berry. Also in Franklin County, developers grabbed 90 acres in Youngsville. A Raleigh development group has dropped big money on close to 90 acres in one of North Carolina's fastest-growing counties. Green Property Development, LLC, purchased 89 vacant acres off Sid Mitchell Road in southwest Franklin County for more than $5.6 million this month, according to Franklin County deed records. The land has a Youngsville address and sits near several residential subdivisions. It's unclear exactly what Green Property Development plans to do with the land. Representatives of the LLC did not respond to requests seeking comment. Filings with the North Carolina Secretary of State show the LLC's members are James Allen Jr., Jeff Grote, Michael E. Jordan, and Yvonne Jordan. It certainly isn't a rarity these days for investments to be pouring into Franklin County, given the county's explosion in population growth. The county's population grew by just shy of 3.5% between 2022 and 2023, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, and we already read that on a previous article. Triangle Business Journal recently reported that an entity tied to Altera Property Group purchased an 8,545-square-foot facility on 8 acres at 94 Cypress Drive in Youngsville for $5.7 million, according to deed records. This week's executive voice feature is about Ty Edmondson. He's the CEO of T.A. Loving Company. Like the new Nike head, Elliot Hill, Ty Edmondson has worked his way from intern to CEO. In the mid-1980s, Edmondson needed a summer job while he was a student at NC State University. And joining one of the largest construction companies in the southeastern United States and based in his hometown of Goldsboro looked like a great opportunity. A lot of my family knew a lot of folks at T.A. Loving Company at the time, so it worked out for me to come to work here, Edmondson said. I had just decided to major in civil engineering about the same time, so it all kind of came together with the type of work and what I wanted to pursue from a degree perspective. In 2023, Edmondson became CEO of a firm that dates to 1925. He's focused on maintaining the family-oriented nature of the firm and its financial stability while navigating challenges like the materials supply chain. TBJ asks, how did it being an intern shape your career? I interned here all of the summers I was in school, and I was able to work in every part of the company, which can be difficult to do. When you come into the company, you tend to come in to work on one type of thing that we do, and at that time, it just worked out very well for me that I got to be exposed to everything we do, because we do a lot of different types of work. We do a lot of bridge work. We do a lot of water and wastewater treatment plant work, a lot of water and sewer line work, and then a lot of building work. So we do lots of different types of construction. Especially now, having those early experiences have really paid dividends. How has T.A. Loving evolved in your time with it? The biggest thing is we're a very family-oriented company. We care about our people. They're our biggest asset. We've got third and fourth generations of different families working in the company. But also, we've always been a place where if you had a goal or a vision for what you wanted to do or what you wanted to be, we've been a place to accomplish that. I think that's kept people in place. The company has had to change and adapt to what markets are available to us at any given time. We're always keeping our eye on the ball. We've historically done a lot more bridge work than we're doing now. That market has diminished a little bit for us, so we've had to move those folks into different types of work. Being able to recognize and then adapt to what the market conditions are, that's been one of the biggest things to T.A. Loving's success for almost 100 years. How has T.A. Loving overcome supply chain issues? We're a company that is very frugal and plans for hard times. That's a benefit in times like we've experienced the last few years, where we couldn't get materials or the lead times were terrible. And what we've had to do is a lot of hard bid work. So when we're read out low, it may be on for a municipal job. It may be 90 to 120 days before we get a contract. What we've had to do with the material issues that we've been dealing with is the day that we're read out low, we were buying material that day to be able to control the price on it. Plus, we were able to deal with the delivery and control it much better in buying it early. What part of your portfolio is growing? We do a lot of infrastructure work, so all the water and wastewater types of work that we do. On the building side of our business, there's a lot of work that there's available to us. Really, everything we're doing other than the bridge work is thriving right now, and the bridge market will come back. But right now, we're able to transition those folks over to a different place in the company, and it works well. The diversity of all types of work we do to play very well in our ability to adapt. And this interview was conducted by Ben Tobin. Developer spends big money on 9 acres in Cary. A developer in the Carolinas and Virginia spent nearly $750,000 per acre to build its next apartment in Cary. Woodfield Investments acquired 9.19 acres in Southeast Cary for $6.9 million, according to Wake County deed records. The land is for Woodfield's 330-unit Macedonia Road apartment project. The price comes to $753,590 per acre. Woodfield bought the four parcels, 2804, 2808, and 2818 Macedonia Road and 2600 Jones Franklin Road in three separate transactions. 2804 and 2808 sold for about $1.7 million. 2818 went for $3.2 million, and 2600 sold for $2 million. Here's a quote from local notable Sarah Bennett. There's nothing like being slapped in the face with your own mortality for you to start reevaluating what truly is and is not important in life, or what is and isn't worth worrying about or losing sleep over. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.